The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're @NewsTalkScience, or you can text us for 30 cent 53106. And as ever, we get to all of your comments in the podcast. Just search for Future Proof wherever you get those. Coming up on this week's show, could you outrun a T-Rex? First, though, we're going to kick off with the week's science stories, and joining me via Skype are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Dungan from wherever she's from. You're both very welcome. Our first story. I believe it's your birthday, Shane.
Woo!
I am 40, would you believe it?
40 well, years old. You don't look
it. Don't have that pause. When I said I'm 40, can you believe it? There was a significant pause.
Just because I can't believe it.
You don't look it. We were stunned into silence. You don't look it or act it. Or have the necessary things done in your life to... No, I'm only joking.
Well, happy birthday, pal.
You. Thank you. No, I'm only joking. You look every second of 40 years old.
I feel it, Jonathan. I feel it.
Would you like to say anything? Would you like to make a little bit of a speech or something? I mean, it's a big... 40 is big. Okay, that's
maybe.
Great.
Let's get into our first story. For the various presents you'd like to send me. Thank you so much.
See, great. That's real classy. All right. Well, now that we've had all that great cheer and fun over with, it's time to talk about the science news, and it's COVID tests.
Lara. Yay.
Okay, so this is me, obviously. Happy birthday, Shane. I'm so delighted. And technically, you're 39 until tomorrow, so we're nearly there. This is a new test that has come out actually from Ireland. It's really interesting research that they did in Beaumont Hospital. And what they did was they took patients who were tested positive for COVID and were admitted to hospital, and they took blood from them every 2 days over a period of from 0 to 7 days, so a period of 8 days. And they looked at inflammatory markers. So when our body is infected with a virus, we have chemicals that we release to try and subdue that virus. But also, as we've mentioned in the show before, these chemicals can do damage to the body itself. And one of the chemicals that we release to subdue a virus or to create an inflammatory response is called IL-6. And another one that we release that actually slightly dampens down the immune system is called IL-10. So what these doctors in Beaumont did is actually really, really practical and useful research. They measured the ratio between IL-6, which is the pro-inflammatory cytokine, IL-10, which is the anti-inflammatory cytokine, and they looked at what this ratio meant for people's outcome. So the World Health Organization has a scale by which they deem how sick somebody is. So if you're somewhere on that scale, which is a numerical point, you either improve, disimprove, or you stay the same. And they measured these people. And this ratio of IL-6 to IL-10 is very, very reliable for how well people, or sadly, how unwell people will become. And it just means that it can help you make clinical decisions. So should someone go on a mechanical ventilator? Should someone sadly come off a mechanical ventilator for a bad reason, or come off it for a very good reason? Will they do well? If our resources start to be pressed, which looks like it might come with this huge spike of cases, you know, who do we allocate the resources to? So it's a really practical way to decide who will do well and who sadly might do badly with the COVID infection.
Essentially, what you're talking about is a biomarker to predict who's going to need serious hospitalization and who won't, which of course would be really useful if we have to make those serious decisions. If people remember in New York when a peak of the pandemic hit, they had to make snap decisions based on the people in front of them, does this person go on a ventilator or not? And they didn't have that information. And of course, that must have led to more fatalities and other people getting treatment that they perhaps didn't need so much. So that is hugely useful. Is it an easy test to do? Is it something that we will be able to roll out very quickly?
You know what? It's easy. It's reasonably cheap. This is a test I used to do when I did my PhD all the time. It's a quick ELISA. You just need serum, which is the liquid part of people's blood. So easy, practical, and hopefully very reliable.
Would this go viral? I was going to say that's not a very good answer. But is this something that could be picked up by hospitals all across the world very quickly, or is it not really?
Definitely, it's something that hospitals would easily have in stock. Yeah, definitely. So I mean, if we start to get overwhelmed and resources have to be allocated, this might be the way to do it.
Very interesting and a great work from Irish researchers. It's always nice to focus on. Shane, another discovery puts another question mark over our understanding of the universe. This is to do with dark matter.
Yeah, so thank God for people like Lara who are doing research where, you know, that can actually impact people's lives. Physicists, meanwhile, continue to worry about things that are far more sort of, you know, underground. So deep in a mountain in Italy, they have a huge 2-ton detector looking for WIMPs, which are particles, hypothesized particles associated with dark matter. And we talked in June about a signal that was unexpected. And that paper has now been published a couple of months later. And alongside it, a whole range of theoretical physics papers have been published, sort of giving more detail on what that signal might be. And so there are three runners here, and all of them would mean new physics, which is great, right? So we're kind of getting closer to understanding what that signal means.
When you say physics, Shane, it's been a while, I suppose, since we've explained the so-called standard model. It might be useful to sort of outline that for people who aren't familiar with it, because new physics means surely a change to that.
Yeah, so the standard model is talking about the matter, basically, what stuff is made out of. And it is
it's how it interacts, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. And so forces and matter are associated with it, everything except gravity, basically. And when I say new physics, people might think, well, God, like, what do you mean? Surely physics is physics. It's as Dara Breen said in one of his stand up shows, science is just the least bad version we have of our explanation of the universe. And so it's slightly improving upon it. And so we have to invent new physics to explain things that we observe. And so that's what these people are trying to do. And you're right, they'll have to play with that standard model of physics, the playbook for physics to make sense of these signals. So one thing is that they could be particles in the sun, so-called neutrinos, behaving in a way that we haven't observed before. Another could be a whole new particle called an axion that's being produced in the sun and that we haven't observed before. And finally, it could be signals of dark matter, but not as predicted, which is interesting. So the predictions of theoretical physicists have been that if a dark matter particle were to come into the xenon tank, it would interact with the xenon molecules in there in a snooker ball-like collision. So something hard hitting something else and then kind of having this, you know,
ricochet effect.
Exactly. Instead, what might be happening is there's a sort of softer interaction where the xenon is absorbing somehow the dark matter, and that results in a release of light, and that could be the signal they're seeing. So there are five very well thought out theoretical papers here, which is brilliant. So what they need now is a lot more data, and there is more than one of these experiments running around the world, and so they're going to collect more data and see which of the models is most accurate.
But the way we understand the world at the moment is fundamentally going to change as a result of that, which is kind of cool. From the randomness of the universe to the randomness of our choices, Lara, this is an interesting study about kids.
I have to say I love this study because I was in a supermarket there about a week ago and I'd done my full shop and I brought it up to the checkout. And obviously now that we have to queue for 2 meters distance, I was able to stand back and watch the person in front of me. And she was offloading all her shopping and every single thing she took out. I remember just thinking to myself, God, that's so alien. I just wouldn't buy that. But in the end, she has everything that I have. So she has everything she needs to survive. I have everything I need to survive. but it was a completely different shot. And then along comes this study. And I think, wow, that's exactly what this is. And we've known for a long time that adults don't choose things because they prefer them, but actually when they make an arbitrary choice, so for instance, one brand of toothpaste over another, one seat on the dart over another, they then decide, they sort of hone in on that and say, look, that's my favorite. And from then on, they choose it. And that's something I hadn't fully realized that we knew about adults, but this research from Johns Hopkins University wants to look at when this actually becomes set up. Is this something that is unique to adults, or do children do it too? So they took nearly 200 babies between the ages of 10 and 20 months, and they gave them two blocks, these lovely soft blocks that were bright colors, but two different colors. And they put them crawling distance away and they let the babies choose which one they wanted to crawl towards. And the babies made their choice. And then what they did was they took away the one that the baby chose and they put in a new toy. And the baby doubled down on their choice pretty much every time they went for the new toy. And okay, you could argue and say, look, it's a new toy. It's more exciting than the one they could see. But then what they did was they took the baby's choice, they put it back in the room, and then they put in a new toy. And again, the babies doubled down and they went for the one they chose. So this is hardwired. We are naturally taught, or it is naturally within our genetics, it seems, to make a choice and just stick to it. Say, look, this is brilliant. I'm wonderful. I made the right choice of the bright pink soft block. And stick to that. I just think this is fascinating.
Yeah, and this is good psychological research to show that this is something that we do. I'm always a bit about talking about psychological research unless there's good evidence behind it on the program, as you both know. I can see you both.
You always do this with psychology. You poo-poo it every time.
Maybe it's boring people hearing that, but just in case it's someone's first time. But
you just poo-poo it though. If psychologists are listening, they must hate you.
I'm sure they do. But can they prove that I'm wrong?
No,
that's a joke. Obviously now I'm going to get into trouble because you've highlighted it. So psychologists, of course, is great science, and actually this is very good, because what the studies I'm talking about, I got people to make a decision, and then behind the scenes the psychologist switched their choice and then asked them why they chose it, and found that consistently people will argue for the reason why they chose something they didn't. And I think that is that really shows this particular effect, this psychological effect, very well. And so this also happens in kids. So I think that is wonderful. And it's also
unreal, and it also
really highlights once again my view of the world, which is determinism, that we don't have free will. We just react to the world around us. I know not everyone believes that way, but that's my current theory. I haven't had it shaken too much by arguments with neuroscientists or philosophers just yet. Our final story is another really interesting one, again from the world of psychology, Shane, but it debunks previous psychology, so you know.
Yeah, this is new work from Stanford University in California, a very prestigious institute, and they've been looking at a previous experiment done in 1987, and it looked at whether couples become more similar in their looks with time. In 1987, a famous experiment was done, a matching experiment. So say what they did is they took someone, say they took you, for instance, and they showed people a picture of you, and then they showed them six potential partners, and one of them would be your partner, and they said, right, based on these six people, who's Jonathan's partner? And they did this for 12 couples, and they concluded in 1987 that people's faces became more alike the longer they were together. And they said the effect was more pronounced the happier they were. Very subjective. So in 2020, the Stanford people have repeated this, and they used technology. So what they did was they scoured Google for photographs of couples where there was multiple time points. So say a couple that was a year together or 60 years together. And they were able to identify 517 couples. They then did a repeat of the 1987 experiment, this matching, right? So who's Jonathan's partner? But they did it with 517 couples. They also asked software to look for similarities between people. And surprise, surprise, they found no evidence, right? So this is completely not supported by the new experiment. So the hypothesis that people start to look more alike with time is not the case, according to this experiment.
I have to say, I'm quite surprised to hear that, Shane, because you know, if you spend a lot of time with your partner, you're exposed to quite a lot of the same environment. You eat the same fatty or prudent foods. You go to the same, holidays. You experience probably similar amounts of sunlight for aging and so on. If you're in a negative relationship, you may get more stressed. I'm quite surprised that after 50 years, I'm still going to be much uglier than my wife.
of course. And science can now show that, Jonathan. So what is known is that people will tend to look for partners who look like them or have similar values to them. And I suppose those things become more aligned the longer we are together. But what they're saying here is that there is no evidence for the fact that you physically start to look like your partner with time.
Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, Dr. Laura Dungan, thank you very much. Have a great birthday weekend, Shane.
Thank you.
All right, coming up next, how fast can a T-Rex run? Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. Or you can also text us for 30¢ 53106. We get to all of your comments in the podcast. Just find it in the News Talk app or wherever you find your podcast. Search for Future Proof. We humans are preoccupied with superlatives. Who's the best? Who's the most talented? Who's the strongest? Who's the fastest? And so on. But when we compare ourselves to animals, other animals, in many respects, we wouldn't have a look in. We can't outmuscle a gorilla, swim faster than a shark, outrun a mouse, let alone a cheetah. But what about animals that are long extinct? Could we outrun a T-Rex? Cody Cassidy is author of Who Ate the First Oyster? He joins me now. Maybe you might start off by telling me what the square cube rule is.
Yeah, so the square cube law is the sort of simple but profound observation that as a object, or in this case an animal, expands, its volume cubes, but its surface area merely squares. So a small square that has a much larger ratio of surface area to volume as a much larger square. And this seems obvious, but it has some really profound implications, particularly for when it comes to dinosaur running speeds, actually.
The idea is that small animals have a much more even ratio between surface area and volume. But the bigger you go, the further distorted that becomes, that huge animals have a much smaller surface area, but lots of volume.
Yeah, well, it particularly is important in bone strength, because bones, as an animal expands, their bone strength squares as a function of its strength, but it's volume cubes. So the bigger an animal gets, the more stress there are going to be on its bones. And at a certain point, a bones like simply cannot hold up an animal. Like, for example, King Kong is an impossibility. Its leg bones would shatter, because there is no way that its leg bones could ever support an animal of that size.
Why not? Well, could you not just have thicker bones?
Yeah, it just turns out that at some point that's just not possible. Well, I suppose it is possible, but it couldn't run, and it certainly couldn't run, and King Kong probably couldn't even walk, because as you walk, you're sort of falling and putting more strain on the bones. So I suppose King Kong could perhaps stand, but he certainly couldn't walk. The strain on the bones would simply be too great.
We know T-Rex could walk, but before we get into figuring out its top speed, how do we calculate these sort of things? How do we know how strong, how powerful, how fast it might be?
So T-Rex was incredibly strong. They know this because they can look at the bones on T-Rex and see the old muscle tissue. So they do know it was actually incredibly strong animal, but they also can see, they of course can reconstruct its size. It was weighed about as much as an elephant does. And then there's another, to estimate its running speed, it's called a dynamically similar gait. This is basically any animal's running speed. Animals' legs move like pendulums, And it's been found that you can get a rough estimation of their speed by if all you know is their hip height and their stride length. And so they can see that from old footprints when dinosaurs were sort of moving across mud. And they can also find their hip height, of course, by looking at their skeletons. And if you have those two factors, you can get a rough estimation of an animal's running speed.
Right. And so could I outrun a T-Rex if it was running after me, as in Spielberg's Jurassic Park?
So a full-grown T-Rex, you probably could. A full-grown T-Rex only runs about 20 kilometers per hour, we think. So which is...
You haven't seen me in the gym, Cody.
Exactly. So it's like, it'd be very scary. It would be a very close race. But you'd have a faster acceleration than a T-Rex, certainly. The full-grown T-Rex could probably only manage a short distance jog and not really with a fast start. So if you had a decent lead and you were, you'd been getting in shape for this moment, we think you could run a full-grown T-Rex.
We're getting into the boundaries of ridiculous now. But so what would happen if it tried to run then?
It couldn't run, so it was more like a fast walker. If we define running as only having one, or sort of as having both legs off the ground at the same time, which is usually how it's defined, it couldn't do that because as we said, the strain on your bones, on the bones, would be far too great. So it's more like a fast walker, and it's so big that it's as tall as a giraffe that it can still manage a pretty quick pace, but it could not run.
Right. And so what other factors influence the speed of an animal? Because obviously you have that hip size and stride length ratio, but there's variability in that. What are the other things that speed up an animal?
Yeah, so acceleration is really critical. And the sort of balance between metabolism and size is also there's sort of a perfect size, it turns out, that an animal can be to be its fastest, which is about 200 pounds or 90 kilograms. And this is because smaller animals have faster metabolism and larger animals are more efficient. Basically, if a small animal has to eat, like a mouse has to eat many times the amount of food per its body weight that a human does, that we do. And the trade-off with this is that we produce proportionally less energy than a mouse does. So a mouse has a really extreme, really fast, fast twitch muscle movement, can accelerate really quickly, and we can't accelerate quite as quickly. Of course, the other trade-off is that we have more muscle power in general than the mouse does, okay? So it's sort of like this relationship between total muscle power and acceleration. And it turns out it's just this parabolic curve, and right about 90 kilograms is sort of the sweet spot where an animal's muscle power and its ability to accelerate its huge mass sort of peaks, which is sort of, about like the size of a cheetah and of course it doesn't determine exactly what an animal's speed is because a cheetah is faster than a human, obviously, but it's a rough guess. So basically we know if you're in the dinosaur age that you should fear the animals that are about 90 kilograms the most. They are going to be the fastest.
The velociraptors possibly.
Yeah. The velociraptor, unlike in the T-Rex or unlike in Jurassic Park, is not that size. It's actually the true velociraptor is about the size of a turkey. So it was kind of fast, but we can, yeah.
How do I not know that?
The animal that looks like the velociraptor in Jurassic Park is called a Delta Dromaeus, and it was very fast. It was about 30 miles per hour, so you would be in a lot of trouble.
How much of a variability is there in this prediction? Are there examples of animals that are calculated using this scale that are way off?
Well, yeah, it's a rough estimation. It's really just sort of it gives us a ballpark of how fast they are, but it's certainly true that there's also a speed limit. We know that basically because you should never fear an animal that's more than like 6,000 pounds or 3,000, just under 3,000 kilograms. Because there's just no way that they can accelerate that amount of mass that quickly. But but it is really just a rough estimation, these various formulas to get an animal's speed.
But when we look at the T-Rex, they're quite long, muscly-legged creatures. Why is that?
Yeah, they actually, the T-Rex has proportionally more muscles devoted to its movement than nearly any animal that's ever lived. It was a remarkably designed and terrifying animal. And in fact, I said you could probably outrun the full-grown T-Rex, but that's certainly not true for a teenage T-Rex. Actually, when a teenage T-Rex still had all those muscles, but it was significantly lighter. It was, only 4 or 5 times the size of you at that point. Maybe like at about 14 years old, it looked a little bit bigger than a racehorse. And that animal was terrifying. It could run about 33 miles per hour, or about over 50 kilometers per hour. So it's
trouble. Yeah, that's about my pace.
If you can imagine a sort of racehorse with really jagged and sharp teeth and very interested in biting you, then that's sort of what a teenage Tyrannosaurus Rex would have looked like.
But if the T-Rex isn't designed to run fast, why is it so muscly and why does it have such long legs?
Long legs actually make it a really efficient walker. The longer an animal's legs, the more sort of the less energy it can use for walking. So archaeologists and paleontologists think it probably was sort of roamed the ground floor looking for other animals, like sort of long walks all day, more than 20 kilometers probably per day walking, and its long legs would give it that efficiency. But it also hunted really large animals, sort of like the Triceratops, which was bigger than it was fast. So it probably would have needed its size more than its speed to take down an animal like that.
So if we're talking about a teenage T-Rex chasing us, obviously speed is one thing, but then, you know, they say, what do they say? If you want to outrun a crocodile, zigzag, isn't that what they say? Is there another strategy that you might use to outrun a T-Rex?
So yeah, there have been some studies, and they have looked at how impalas outrun cheetahs, for example. And cheetahs have a much faster top speed than an impala, almost twice as fast, actually. And they have a faster acceleration. They can turn faster. Basically, they in almost every aspect, they are more athletic and faster. And yet, the impala gets away more than 2/3 of the time. And this is why I actually had some hope for you in that race in the T-Rex, because even if they are faster and they are better acceleration, they can turn better, there are some advantages in being chased. And if they've looked at the impala, and actually the best strategy is not to sprint away as fast as you can in one direction, just like you think you would if a T-Rex were chasing you. But instead, the impala, it runs at about 70 or 80% of its top speed. And then when the cheetah gets very close, it sort of turns very quickly. You can turn faster if you're not running your absolute flat out top speed. And when it does so, it gains a few yards as the cheetah takes an inefficient route back to it. And if it does this enough times, the cheetah tires out and the impala escapes. So I would recommend that, if a full-grown T-Rex were chasing you, you sort of use the same strategy. You don't actually run at your top speed. You sort of, just like if a bully were chasing you on the playground, you know, this is like when the bigger guy is running after you, you use a little unpredictability, you might get away.
What about endurance? Humans have an amazing ability to run, and we have a genetic superpower that is long distance running that allows us to sweat and reduce heat as we run, which is almost the peak of our abilities from a natural kingdom point of view, right? So with a T-Rex, how long would they be able to run for, do we know?
Yeah, this is a really difficult question to answer. I looked into this, and it's true that humans have, we are one of the greatest endurance creatures. That's sort of our greatest athletic ability, really. And endurance is a hard thing to estimate with just bones and stride length. And as I was saying before, that the T-Rex actually probably did have pretty good endurance because it had those long legs, so it would have enabled it to move pretty efficiently. Nevertheless, I think given its size and given our incredible endurance, it's probably safe to guess that you have better endurance than the T-Rex. So I think the strategy I was discussing earlier, where you sort of out-tire and outrun the T-Rex and just barely get away for a while, we can guess the T-Rex would probably tire faster than you do.
Yeah, depending on what we've had for breakfast and how long it's been since we've been in the gym, I suppose. Cody Cassidy, yeah. Author of Who Ate the First Oyster, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I have to say, I am quite embarrassed that I did not know velociraptors were the size of turkeys. Did you know that, Aidan?
No, absolutely not.
I think Jurassic Park has a lot to answer for because, you know, I really loved the film, but like, it got a lot of shit wrong.
Yeah, so like before that film, I had no fear of velociraptors or no idea of what they were. And now I realize that I was right to completely ignore them. Surely if they're the size of a turkey, they're grand.
All right, Aidan McKelvey, as you can hear, producer of the podcast, is here to go through our texts and tweets from last week. And we asked last week, you know, why are there no fat monkeys in the jungle? Because obviously in many forests, food is abundant, and yet you never see monkeys like slouching around. Like, name someone who's overweight, Aidan.
Homer Simpson.
Like, oh, yeah,
always
nice, go, nice and safe.
Always good to go Homer, with the,
yeah, with the fictional character. You just don't see Homer Simpson monkeys around. We spoke to Callie on the phone about the five appetites that we have, which is not sweet, sugar, sour, bitter, and umami. It's actually quite different. It's protein, fat, and basically the things that we need to survive. What is it? Protein, fat,
oh God, calcium, you're putting me on a spot here. Yeah, and then there was two
carbohydrates.
There was two chemical or two kind of vitamins or chemicals or something that made out the list that I wasn't familiar with.
Calcium,
but it was protein, carbohydrates, yeah, fats, and two other things.
It shows how much we pay attention to our own program. But it was a good piece, despite not remembering too much of it. But Chris says, there's no fat jungle monkeys because the manufacturer who makes their food doesn't put profit-led cheap salt, trans fats, or sugar in their food chain. Yep, that's one of the things. I mean, when you look at, I always remember, I just come off the phone with an interview with someone we had on the program talking about obesity. And as I did, Reeling in the Ears was on, and I think it was like the first Trip to Tip. And I looked at, you know, crowds of men and women in the 70s or early 80s. There wasn't a big boned person among them. Like, we, only 30 to 35 years ago, were skinny mothers in this country. And yet now we see the diet has changed dramatically and we see a lot more obesity, but like, everyone was really skinny, you know?
Yeah, well, we were very poor, but I suppose actually today a lot of people who would be considered poor or impoverished would have obesity issues as well. So I guess, yeah, the food that's available
has
changed.
The script is flipped, Aidan.
Yeah, it's totally flipped the script. It's actually, I thought it was really interesting that thing that you said about proteins and something like, you know, a bag of chips. It's like the fat in it gives you your brain the idea that there must be protein
in there
to go
somewhere.
With that fat. Just isn't.
Yeah, there it isn't. It's going. It's like a you know, when you were very last in those. Do you remember those big buckets of Lucky Dip? And when you were a kid, you put your hand in and rummage around and try and find something. When you were the last kid in the queue, it's kind of like that. You're like, it's got to be in here somewhere.
Yeah, but like, if I was a conspiracy theorist, maybe I would agree with our texter and say that somehow, even though this is brand new research, the fast food companies knew this principle years before the scientists did. But I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so I don't say that.
We also had Derek O'Keefe on talking about physician ears and the idea that doctors who have an understanding of engineering can be really useful. And I think he's so right, but you're talking about the top of the top brains, aren't you? Those are two tricky things to stick together. like being able to understand Inception, be a physician, and also be an engineer. Like, that's the Holy Trinity. No one has that. You can have two of those things at tops, but no one has all three things. Anyway, we got a nice text for him saying, "Brilliant man, we really need people like you. I bet you watched Sabrina the Teenage Witch too." Now, I didn't know that Sabrina the Teenage Witch was either a physician or an engineer. Is this an obtuse reference, or do you get this, Aidan?
No, God, I was hoping you'd get that. I have no idea how Sabrina the Teenage Witch
fits into our conversation. Oh, maybe it's
there
the glove.
There must be a magic glove. Yeah, there must have been a magic glove.
Yeah, I see.
We should emphasize, being the science show, that this glove is not magic.
No, it's not.
Good science.
It may be magic. We just don't have evidence to support that hypothesis right now. And finally, we were talking about, in Newsround, the research that showed that dogs' brains light up pretty much the same if you show them a human's face or the back of a human's head. So they get excited seeing a human, but they don't really care what they're looking at. So our face does not matter to a dog. And I'm sure that's very upsetting to dog owners everywhere. But Adrian says, maybe dogs don't react to seeing a human face because they recognize their owners or human friends by smell. Seems obvious. Well, Adrian, you've fallen into a bit of a trap there that I crawled out of after 3 years of doing the program, realizing that obvious and proven in evidence are two different things. And a great example of that might be, you know, if you found, if you asked somebody, you know, who's got better mental health, someone who lives in the country or on their own, or someone in the city who's surrounded by lots of people. And of course, you could find findings to support either of those. And if I came out and said, turns out people who live in the country are way happier, you go, well, of course, because they haven't got the stress of the city. But if I said, turns out people in the city are happier, we'll say, well, yeah, because they're not on their own and they, you know, they got the buzz of people. And so things only seem obvious after the fact, but actually proving that they're so is what's interesting. And of course, asking for evidence, even when we assume something, can sometimes turn out some really interesting stuff. Isn't that right, Aidan?
It is. Well, another thing that would seem incredibly obvious is that dogs can see your face and react to it, but apparently they don't. So
yeah,
the example
exactly.
is sort of in
yeah.
the question.
Exactly, yeah. Answer leading the question. Very good. That's well put. Aidan, I don't know, we've nothing else, but I haven't spoken to you a while. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Good considering. I mean, I miss my weekly Jonathan McRae chat, but other than that, everything's great.
Yeah, I've been away and busy. And we're trying to organize these calls over the pandemic and with the background of kids, and it can be stressful. So it's good. It's good to hear your voice. Good to have you back
Yours
on the
too.
Show. All right, man. We'll do it again next week, I guess. That's it from us on the podcast. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, you heard the producer, Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, and Steve Daunt, who were researching. Steve McLuhan was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed, where we're going to be talking about how to survive a zombie apocalypse. There's not a huge amount of science in it, to be honest, but it's cool. You get to talk about zombies. That's on Tuesday in the podcast feed. We'll see you then. In the meantime, stay curious.